So we're in Santa Barbara at a workshop on epigenetic regulation of aging with Shelley Berger, who is a molecular geneticist at the University of Pennsylvania and director of the epigenetics program there. Epigenetics is not a word that people use on a regular basis outside on the street there. Would you hazard a definition of what we mean by epigenetics?
There's a number of different definitions, but the one that that we're discussing at the meeting is a non-mutational inheritance of physical traits are inherited from you know through heredity, and much of that is based on mutations, changes in our genes, changes in the DNA sequence. But there are non-genetic, non-gene-based inheritance, traits that are transmitted through through cell division and through lineages of families. They're non-mutational, and they're caused by changes in proteins, in molecules that associate with the DNA. So they're not changes in the DNA. So the most common idea is that you have a mutation in a gene, sickle cell anemia, something like that. You've got a mutation in globin, and that causes it changes to the red blood cell. That's carried on, you know, that's inherited from, you know, through from parents to offspring. But what I'm talking about are they're not changes in the DNA sequence. They're changes that cause inherited changes. That are not changes in DNA sequence. So epigenetic means on top of genes. So these are changes that occur that alter. What I'm most interested in are things that alter the way genes are regulated, are turned on and off, but not changes to the DNA sequence.
So these changes are heritable or not?
They are heritable. That's right, the key issue.
Okay, but let me.
They're transmitted through cell division.
Okay.
And the question is how. I mean, this is a major question.
Here's where I think this is worth unpacking a little bit more. Mm-hmm. I think the general perception is that, okay, there's this process called natural selection, which Darwin described. Mm-hmm. And as a result mm-hmm. of environmental pressures, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth, mm-hmm. the survival of the fittest is the usual
yes.
phrase. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you and genes, are, you know, are passed on.
Right.
Genetic information is passed mm-hmm. on through replication, so
mm-hmm.
on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And giraffes have got long necks.
That's right. So what you're coming up to is, doesn't this sound like Lamarckian?
It does sound like Lamarck.
Yes, so that's been brought up many now.
Yes.
As the study of epigenetics takes a larger and larger prominence in basic research and then in society as a whole, talking about diet and changes impinging from the environment that are changing the expression of genes and are passed on through generations, all of a sudden it sounds a lot like Lamarckian.
Yeah, and the reason I was giving the standard example is, why does giraffes have a long neck?
Giraffes extend their necks.
And the answer would be
right. Yeah. Well, there's a base, you know.
Not because the fruit's high up there and it grows
correct.
A long neck to deal with the fruit, and then that's all gone for the next generation.
Right.
How do you?
Well, it is possible that natural selection could operate on epigenetics as well as genetics. It's certainly possible. But it's still natural selection in the sense that it's not acquiring, you know, it's not you're not I was about to say that you're not purposefully acquiring characteristics, but the truth is it's possible. So you could imagine if you change your diet in some
right.
very in some way that could be transmitted into your germ cells, then that could be passed on. Now, that's a big if, because most things aren't transmitted. Most of what we're talking about is operating on our soma, on our bodies. It's not going to get into our eggs or sperm and be carried on. There are things that are transmitted epigenetically through our germ cells, through our gametes, our sperm and eggs, but most of what we're talking about sort of is operating on our
Yeah, I'm not trying to be difficult here. It's just that
right. it's confusing.
It is confusing, mm-hmm. and
right.
even scientists within meetings. If I went back into that room and asked mm-hmm. all those people down
yes.
there what they meant by epigenetics,
yes.
I'd have a problem, and there'd be
you
different
would.
Answers.
You would.
David Haig did a
That's
paper
right.
on this some
mm-hmm.
years ago, in which he talked about the various uses of the term.
Right.
And I do think it's worth understanding mm-hmm. a little bit better, because
mm-hmm.
the original phrase comes mm-hmm. from Waddington, as you well
That's
know,
right.
late 30s, early 40s.
That's right.
And he was setting that out
mm-hmm.
as in opposition to a simplistic one gene for one trait mentality.
That's right.
He
yeah.
was saying, well, you go through ontogeny, through development,
right.
there are shifts, changes, and you,
right.
this is what you were talking about.
Right.
That there are things.
He thought of a landscape of development
right.
where you had the potential to develop, cells had a potential to develop in many different directions and
right.
would take on different developmental courses.
Because to just do the absolute devil's advocate
mm-hmm.
position on this,
mm-hmm.
if the two extremes, I mean, if you're saying that Waddington was wrong and there's
mm-hmm.
no such thing as epigenetics, for
mm-hmm.
example,
mm-hmm.
then you're saying that the genes generate outcomes, behaviors, everything.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, all the shows that you see about changing your diet, it's irrelevant.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not going to do you any good.
Right.
Well, that can't be right, can it?
Well, I mean, those are two different questions. I mean, diet could operate on you, on your metabolism, without affecting you epigenetically.
Okay. So that could improve your life during the during your life.
Right, through metabolism.
That would be the end of it.
Right, not changing the regulation of the genome, or changing
right.
genes turning on and off. But what epigenetics refers to is so for example in twins, if you look at the epigenome of young identical twins, they look identical. But as twins age, if you look at identical twins through their lifespan, you see that changes are occurring to these proteins, not to the genes themselves. No changes in DNA sequence, but changes that you can detect by sophisticated experimentation. You can detect changes to the epigenome, to the what I'm going to bring in one more word, to the chromatin, which is the association of the DNA with the proteins that are helping to package it, much the way thread is packaged around a spool. So the spool, you think of the spool as the proteins that help to package the DNA, and the simple way to explain it is that chemical changes occur to the spool, not to the DNA, to the spool, the packaging material, the styrofoam that's helping to package this huge, long 3 meters of DNA into each one of your tiny little cells. That packaging material is regulating these little chemical changes that are occurring to the proteins can be regulating the DNA. Okay. So that's chromatin, the protein plus the DNA that constitutes the material of our chromosomes. Okay. And so epigenetic changes then, you know, epigenetic, so there, so now we have to bring in one more concept. There's regulation that's quite dynamic of the genes by these chemical changes on the packaging material, mm-hmm. that isn't persistent. It's not epigenetic. We want to reserve that word epigenetic for changes that are persistent through cell division, because those are the really interesting ones. They're going to determine how the single cell that we begin with, the fusion of the sperm and the egg, first cell, as Waddington's landscape emerges, the development of all the tissues that make up the complex organism that we are, and all organisms on Earth, you know, complex organisms, mm-hmm. The epigenetic changes are changes that are persisting, that are going to dictate whether you've got liver cells or blood cells or neurons. There is no change to the DNA sequence in all the complex tissues of our body. All the changes that occur are epigenetic, and they're persistent. You know, there are your lineages or cells are not going back. They're not going back to a less differentiated state. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the major concept that I'm trying, that I think epigenetics really needs to be reserved. You've got dynamic regulation of the chromosomes by chromatin, and then you've got epigenetic changes that are persisting through cell division. And so I think that's the key, those persistent changes.
All right. Now, so since you said that some personal choices that you could make about, say, your diet,
mm-hmm.
could produce epigenetic changes.
Yes.
Could you just walk me through that step? Mm-hmm. Suppose I decide to mm-hmm. have a calorie-restricted diet,
yes.
or cut most sugars out of my diet, or
right.
whatever.
Right.
What cascade mm-hmm. of events then happens, and how are they?
Well, no one really knows, but calorie restriction is a really good one, because we know that calorie restriction affects a protein that changes those chemical groups on the packaging material that the DNA is organized by. And so calorie restriction leads to increased activity of this enzyme. This enzyme, its role is to remove a particular kind of this chemical group that's on these proteins. The chemical group, its property is, in general, you know, I'm simplifying, is to open up the DNA. So where genes are being expressed,
mm-hmm.
you see this chemical group, and where genes are off, you don't see it. So this enzyme, its function in part is to remove that chemical group, keep genes off, and to simplify again, aging in many cells involves too much opening of the DNA, okay? So too much of that chemical group that opens up and allows parts of our DNA to be open, to be genes to be on, regions of the DNA that need very badly to be compacted. They're available, and so there's damage, all sorts of damage, ends of chromosomes, areas of the DNA that are highly repeated, that are helping to that need to be off.
Mm.
If they're on, you get all sorts of damage and breakage of chromosomes, fusions like translocations that you see in cancer, all kinds of very bad changes.
Now,
so we don't know the details. I'm giving you sort of pieces of data from many laboratories and many studies, trying to understand
Now, to put names on some of these things, because you do read about these things. So the ends that you were talking about
telomeres,
would be called telomeres.
Those are called telomeres.
And telomerase would be?
Telomerase is an enzyme that keeps the ends long.
Right.
So the ends are, the ends need to be closed up. That's a very important area that needs to be compacted. Because the ends, they look like breaks in the DNA to the cell, and so they are you can get fusions at the ends of chromosomes. In fact, in aging cells, you often see end-to-end fusions of chromosomes, suggesting that some of this packaging is deteriorating and allowing these ends to open up. And
so it's kind of like the packaging's got out of the way and stuff has leaked.
That's right.
Turning into a mess.
That's right. Turning into a mess and bad things happen.
We do know, and there's lots and lots of things we could go into here. We're just focusing on one little example to get some flavor here.
Yes.
So that telomerase is maintaining the length of telomeres.
Right.
Stress can shorten telomeres, right?
Yes.
So I suppose that could be, is that just, are we talking about endocrine stress there, the stress of the system? Are we talking about mental stress? I mean, what kind of stress are we talking about when we read that stress can shorten telomeres?
I think probably the easiest way to think about it is either DNA damage or metabolic stress. Alcohol, what other sorts of stress? I don't know. There certainly hasn't been any direct connection that I know of between stress and changes in telomerase.
See, and what was the group that you were talking about? What was the name of the group you were talking about before?
The chemical group. It's called an acetyl group.
Right. So acetylation is a very major important. So I was talking to Gary Ruvkun yesterday, and he was saying to me, you know, compared to quantum mechanics, biology is easy. Well, I sat there and I nodded and I thought, well, having watched some of these talks now and seeing the alphabet soup of
the
abbreviations of all the terms.
It's a big problem.
I have no idea where the terms came from because they seem to be rather randomly assigned, some of them. It's actually not an easy thing to convey at all.
Yes.
How a cell works. And you move beyond that and say, well, are there any theories of aging? And what can we get hold of here? There's a simple take home, and the answer is there isn't a simple take home. It's still an enormously complicated
problem. I think that's correct.
Problem.
And I don't think there's going to be any one. I think that's one thing from that I'm taking away. So, interestingly, I'm not, by training a biologist of aging. I've studied initially how genes are turned on and off, and then when this chromatin regulation that I was talking about before became clear, it became clear that it was very important to turning genes on and off. I started to study that, and that led me into the study of aging only over the last couple of years. My interest has been how are some of these again, trying to go from the details of these molecular mechanisms to the gestalt of physiology. So aging is a really interesting physiological state where I would like to understand that whole middle area between the complexity of the sirtuin, so the sirtuin, which takes off the acetyl group, and acetylation coming on and off. We can see that in the genome. We can measure it, and then understanding how does all this relate to aging? How do you get from the details of the molecular biology to the physiological state? So I'm coming at this quite naive. This is the first aging conference I've been to. And what I'm struck by is perhaps what you are also struck by. There appear to be a lot of different molecular mechanisms. And it's not one simple base. I don't think there's going to be one simple explanation. I think there are a number of different explanations that, you know, capture themes. There are themes. There's DNA damage, you know, that's caused by the kinds of abuses you were asking about before, metabolic stresses that take many forms, bad diet, alcohol, cigarette smoking. These things all cause metabolic damage, cause changes in metabolism and DNA damage that result in triggering aging, as well as other diseases. So that's one major influence on aging. I think there are other molecular mechanisms that are, you know, being covered at the conference. There's a natural, I think there's just a age-related change in, for reasons we don't quite understand, there are changes in the levels of these enzymes that have a role in regulating the epigenome. We're trying to understand what they are, so we can see that SIR2 in yeast are the model that we use, a very simple genetic model to try to understand human aging. We're studying this one single cell simple organism, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, or budding yeast, the sort of yeast that's used in baking bread or brewing beer. We can study SIR2, this enzyme that removes the acetyl groups.
As you're saying this, I should make that clear, that that's an SIR and then a 2.
Yeah.
And SIR2. It's a SIR2.
And the family is based on SIR2. It's been called the very broad family that encompasses all of these enzymes in all, everything from yeast to mammalian to human cells, sirtuins, S-I-R-T-U-I-N.
And just to take that a little bit further, what the average person knows about that, and what I try and do is put myself in that situation.
Yes, yep.
Is reading stories in the New York Times or other places by Nick Wade about resveratrol.
That's right, resveratrol.
And having one glass of red wine
a day
will help you live longer, would be the simple
30
story.
30 liters of red wine, but if you're willing to consume.
So, but why, see, here's an example. Mm-hmm. Why is, I mean, if I went out there and asked people now if they...
why is red wine beneficial?
There's so many people would tell me that one or two glasses of red wine a day is beneficial.
Yes.
How much resveratrol is there going to be in one or two glasses?
Almost vanishingly small.
How much resveratrol does it appear that one would need to take to have these kind of...
About 30 liters, I'm not exaggerating.
All right.
The equivalent. So the mouse studies have been done by David Sinclair and others. Suggests that that for a mouse, if you scale up from a mouse to a human, it would you'd require a dose equal to 30 liters of red wine. So what's the take home from that? That we have to look for new activators of these sirtuins that have this very beneficial effect of removing the acetyl groups and keeping our genomes compact, which is, keeping the cells young, not damaged, compact, no problems occurring, no fusions, etc. New activators that are much more potent, new activators of sirtuins, much more potent in much lower doses, so that we can. We can consider actually using those. I do want to point out, for accuracy, resveratrol is not clearly directly binding to sirtuins and regulating them. The mechanism is not clear, so that's also a bit of a misinformation in even the scientific community. I think it's pretty clear that it's not a direct interaction. But there's a search on for direct activators of sirtuins that will activate them at much lower doses and could be efficacious.
Right. So in the interim, and if there isn't a pill that one takes that actually is as concentrated as 30 litres of wine,
right,
why is there a general perception that one should be drinking one or two glasses of red wine? I'm not asking you to be a sociologist of trends.
I'm genuinely baffled. Sociologically speaking, observations that are made by scientists are translated into some simplified, highly simplified version that I can't really explain completely why that happens.
We'll go back to aging, simplified by scientific journalists.
All
right. Well, we'll go back to aging in a minute. But let me just sort of take a point here, which is that since we spend a lot of our time on the Science Network talking about issues at the intersection of science and social policy, and therefore how the information that comes from the bench is deployed and how it's received.
Yes.
And it's very easy to blame the man in the street as being a scientific ignoramus and so on and so forth. But one wonders how best to improve the way in which the traffic goes. And it's certainly the case, I would say, that people seem to have an opinion that science delivers certitude and that they take the information that comes from the scientists and find. Must be proved, facts of the matter, let's move on. You know perfectly well that that's not what science does, that it's a moving target.
Ongoing process. Of inquiry, discovery, refinement, new questions.
I've said many times we're not in the belief business, we're in the doubt business.
That's right.
But on the other hand, to get the grants that allow you to do the bench work, sometimes the case that you have to make
overstatements or
promises. So it's a very tricky area.
It is tricky. So I think epigenetics is a good area to discuss in this way because it's not clear what the agents of persistence of these states are, and it's really a work in progress. It's definitely not an area, you know, the New York Times has had, and the Science Times has had front page stories on epigenetics in the last year. And, you know, conveying this idea, I think, with my read of those articles that are reaching a pretty educated lay public is that we know quite a lot about the way epigenetics occurs and how and what the landscapes are of these modifications that we're talking about, these chemical groups across the genome, and not just acetylation, but there are many different kinds of them. You know, it's a complex field. Still trying to understand the basic biology. So it's easy to try to look for simplifying ideas, you know, that are often incorrect. I think that that incorrect ideas are disseminated in the public because of the desire to simplify and for take home messages, sound bites. You know, I do it in my talks. You know, you have to simplify.
So it would be kind of depressing, I suppose, to say, well, look, actually, Francis Bacon, one of the great statesmen of science and one of the founders of the scientific enterprise, set out some fairly interesting questions and observations about the whole notion of longevity and aging and so on in 1610 to 1620, and we're still fumbling around with the same basic questions. Mm-hmm. There is no clearly defined theory of aging that everybody subscribes to.
I think that's accurate.
There's a trend there that said, okay, well, why is there senescence? Why are there these organisms that, unless somebody hits them with a shovel or runs over them on the road, would go on forever and still reproduce? So what's that about?
Well, I mean, there are different explanations for different or for different complexities of organisms, for humans that we reproduce at a pretty young age, at least females do. Selection is really only operating on us before we reproduce. After we reproduce, there's really no selection. And so aging, in part, could be a result of, there's no real, there's a chicken and egg problem here, then why not select for older and older reproduction in females, and then that would delay aging. Well, there is some of that maybe going on. I'm not sure how much of that is.
Well, why do these non-trivially organized creatures called Blandings turtles still keep on reproducing, so on and so forth?
Which
is, as Tuck Finch would say, a challenge to explain away.
Right.
And then we have all these different theories about...
Well, they're very interesting questions, and some of them have been discussed at the meeting, trying to understand why, there are a lot of explanations. I'm not sure. I'm the best.
Okay, but and we'll get into this with some other people. But as I mentioned to you, here you go to a bookstore, right? Mm-hmm. You pick up a book that's completely current by Michael Brooks. Who's a very good writer from New Scientist. And he's got a book here called 13 Things That Don't Make Sense, mm-hmm. the most baffling scientific mysteries of our time.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is death.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where in obviously it's just a chapter of the book,
mm-hmm.
a popular book, but it does raise some issues about the lack of agreement, coherence, and clarity about some of the theories of senescence that are out there.
Mm-hmm.
Leonard Hayflick, who is well known for the Hayflick mm-hmm. limit and suggesting that there's a limit to that there's a replicative senescence,
mm-hmm.
so that you get through sort of 50 generations of cells in a petri mm-hmm. dish and
yes.
they cut out. That's
mm-hmm.
the end of it.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's what we study in my lab in the yeast system.
But then you have yeah. people saying, "Well, that's one thing." The Hayflick.
Well, okay. So one clear possibility is that it's a consequence of simply having to, if we want to talk about epigenetics, it's simply a consequence of having to open and close the DNA. That
but
if you've got to open the DNA, then the DNA is going to be. It's going to be subject to damage.
Yeah, let me just finish off this.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean to interrupt, but here's the Hayflick opening sentence in the Journal of Gerontology, a rather well-known article that he wrote.
Mm-hmm.
No intervention will slow, stop, or reverse the aging process in humans.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I would never go and say that anyway.
Right, I don't think that's
and certainly
true.
Aubrey de
Grey, I think we can see that there's
would argue against
there's
it.
There's certainly. I mean, I think lifespan has gone, increased, twofold in 300 years? Like the average lifespan
right,
of
but
humans.
Right, I guess he would say that there's no intervention happened, it's just that we're eating better and there's better medicine and the water's not full of microbes. So.
Well, I think that... that may or may not be right. If you calorie restriction could be considered...
Yeah.
An intervention, in the sense that I don't know how you want to define intervention,
yeah.
but we could calorie restrict by taking a drug, resveratrol,
right.
to mimic calorie restriction.
Yeah.
So.
And I'm not being not trying to be negative about this. I'm just
mm-hmm.
genuinely. I find this particular field so fraught with off ramps and conceptual. Cul-de-sacs and confusions that
mm-hmm.
I...
Which field are you talking about now? Aging?
Aging.
Mm-hmm.
And the different
mm-hmm.
theories and so on. But
I'm with you. I'm coming in fairly, new to this field, and I find it confusing as well. More confusing than maybe the reason is that aging is a phenomenon. It's not a biological property in the sense of other sorts of physiological things that are, like cancer. If you want to talk about other diseases, you know, diabetes, cancer. These are much easier to understand because there are pathways that we can study, that we can point to and say, you know, these are the pathways, these are the molecules, these are the mechanisms that are involved in these diseases. Cancer, it's true, is many, you know, there are lots of different cancers and different pathways, but we can point to very clear mechanisms in common between all of the cancers, tumor suppressors like P53 or RB, you know, or oncogenes that are, you know, mm-hmm. overexpressed and they lead to cancer, MYC and other things. So we have some very simple pathways that we can point to.
So the analogy would be
But with aging's like many things. It's a lot of different diseases, it's a lot of different, you know, it's not a disease. It's not one disease and one simple, it's not a pathway that's, right. You know, I mean, I am, you know, we're trying to address it as a pathway in yeast, but I'm not sure even in yeast it's a simple pathway and not the acquisition through a lot of different mechanisms of changes that,
well, look,
and hence the idea that it can't be, you can't intervene.
Yeah.
Too many different pathways impinging.
Yeah, there's two points here. I mean, one of them is obviously this whole sense of the people involved in talking about what is literally a quest for immortality. I mean, that's obviously unpacking that is going in one direction. Mm-hmm. Then there's the purely reductionistic, mechanistic level of saying what is this phenomenon that we're mm-hmm. exploring here.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe one thing we could do here is let's come at this through your trajectory, your personal trajectory.
Mm-hmm.
Because in your talk,
mm-hmm.
You're talking about yeast, but you're also talking about sort of ants at mm-hmm. the end. You were talking, mm-hmm. pointing out that queen ant lives anything from 40 to possibly hundreds of times longer mm-hmm. than a worker ant.
That's right.
Same species, what's that about?
Yeah. I mean,
so what's yeah. the... Mm-hmm. trajectory in your own personal mm-hmm. involvement in this? How did you get mm-hmm. into this as well?
Mm-hmm. The interest there, the aging aspect is absolutely fascinating, and we can get to that in a second, but my interest really came from years ago as an undergraduate. I was interested in evolutionary biology and behavior, and eusocial insects are the, you know, most fascinating example of behavioral evolution, because ants, eusocial ants, bees, wasps, and ants, eusocial insects, they form colonies that, and they divide up the tasks into what are called behavioral morphs or castes, if you like, which are completely analogous to the way our organism has divided up the tasks of running a body, you know, into different tissues, different organs, all of the different, you know. So we, every one of our cells has exactly, precisely the same DNA content as every other cell, identical. And yet our organism has differentiated from one, we talked about this earlier, from one one cell into all these different complex tissues that divide up all the work of running running an organism. An ant colony has divided up the work among different behavioral castes. So genetically speaking, the queen and the female workers are, you know, it's not clear yet if they're genetically identical, but the genetics is not what can explain the differences in their behavior. They have, they are genetically virtually, they're very similar, and so we believe that the changes in their behavior is epigenetic. there are changes that occur in the sorts of molecular pathways we've been talking about that lead to huge morphological differences. Mm. A queen is in mass. I'm not certain what the number is. The queen is to look at her, she's 10 to 20 times larger than a worker. The worker has given up reproduction, is unfertile, and so the queen, as you know, it's commonly known, does all the reproduction for the colony. One queen can reproduce for a colony over, as you said, over decades, literally decades. One queen can live that long and can reproduce for the colony. Now, in some species, if the queen, this is where the really interesting stuff with respect to epigenetics and our interest, if something happens to the queen in some species of ant, of eusocial ant, the workers can fight among themselves, and one can now emerge as a reproductive, can go from being over her lifetime non-reproductive and now acquire through means we don't know, now it becomes fertile and can start laying eggs and for the colony, for the nest. So that's a fascinating question, how that occurs.
And it is not known whether there is some genetic switch, metabolic switch of some kind.
There are undoubtedly metabolic switches. There are changes in brain function. The workers divide up the tasks, and there's yet, you know, the pinnacle of all of this is the leafcutter ant. And my, what happened with me is, I have long been, so as I said, I studied this sort of thing as an undergraduate, but the molecular tools to try to understand the differentiation of these behavioral morphs were not available, right, you know, 20 years ago. So I went into molecular biology. I wanted to learn how do genes turn on and off, because I figured, well, that must be the source of the difference between queens and female workers that are non-reproductive.
Yeah.
So flash forward 20 years later, and now the tools are available to try to understand what is the difference on an epigenetic level between a queen and a worker, and we can manipulate, our collaborators can have laboratory models, models which mean great species for studying this, where they can manipulate the colony, remove the queen, and you can see the workers start to fight, and one worker become reproductive. And so we can do that in the lab. We can study that. What happens epigenetically to a worker when she goes from being a non-reproductive forager or, you know, serving the colony by taking care of larvae and pupae and helping to rear the colony, to becoming, giving all that up, becoming kind of a stupid queen. Queen is, in a way, stupid. Many of her neuronal functions have deteriorated, apparently. Again, I'm not. My specialty is finding great collaborators in the aging field, in the field of insect behavior, and finding ways to apply to try to understand how these epigenetic phenomena are involved in these really interesting physiological phenomena.
So Ed Wilson and Bert Hulder, mm-hmm, would be the ant, mm-hmm, men.
Those are the guys. So
the go-to men for ants.
The go-to men. I haven't talked to E.O. Wilson about this, but when I decided to try to get into this area, I contacted Bert Holdover, and the guy I'm working with, Jürgen Liebig, at Arizona State. Our other collaborator is Danny Reinberg at NYU. Bert got me in touch with Jürgen. Who's interested in some of these behavioral, what are the mechanistic molecular underpinnings of, he didn't know too much about epigenetics, right. So we're schooling him in that, and he's schooling us in biology of, of ants.
I mean, that's an interesting trend, by the way, that that there has been a there was a phase where science became extremely siloed and
highly specialized. Absolutely.
And people are now, as you find, beginning to have to go build more bridges and collaborations.
That's right. That's right. There's
your actual
trend
job at Penn is a reflection of
right.
something like that happening at Penn, right?
That's correct. So at Penn, Amy Gutman, who's the president of Penn, developed when she came in as president. She established a so-called university professorship. So this is a series of appointments of faculty members that would bridge different disciplines and try to bring them together and sort of, you know, illuminate, bring new ways of looking at previously separate disciplines. So I have an appointment in the School of Medicine, in the School of Arts and Sciences, in the Biology Department, and the Genetics Department, Cell and Molecular Biology Department, in the Medical School. And the reason, and I'm very grateful about this appointment, it's a very nice appointment, is that the idea is that we can start to bring together, you know, neurobiology, biology behavior with these epigenetic mechanisms that really sprung up out of medicine and biomedical research. You know, that's really how most of this, you know, I've been talking about yeast, which doesn't sound much like a biomedical organism, but actually it's been a great model for biomedical research and funded, you know, a lot of work funded by the National Institutes of Health. Now, ant work isn't funded by the National Institutes of Health, it's funded by National Science Foundation, et cetera. So you can see that cultures grow up that are siloed, you know, scientific cultures grow up separately, you know.
Right. As a consequence of funding sometimes. But and your collaborator at ASU, Arizona State University, ASU, of course, famous for also knocking down walls and building bridges, Michael Crow calling it the New American University, and setting up centers.
Yes, and Penn is very good at
with collaborative
lots
sentiment.
Of centers. So I've been asked to put to develop a epigenetics program at Penn, which is again cross departmental. I've only been at Penn for 3 months, and we've created this new program. It's a virtual program. There's a virtual part and an actual part. The virtual part is composed of scientists from lots of different schools. So we'd like to bring in engineers, physicists. So we don't yet have any of those, but we have people from the biology department, you know, the vet school, dental school, school of medicine, that are talking to each other, have meetings. It would be fantastic to bring in engineers, and you know, the science of epigenetics is hugely a computational science, because a lot of the work that's being done by looking across entire genomes, trying to understand how these chemical groups that we were talking about before, how they change in aging organisms through disease, cancer, etc. So we need computational biologists as well.
Right. And this is not an off-ramp. I'm making this point because if you, especially if you deal with something like aging, epigenetics or aging, it seems to me that you really are having to invoke and call upon the talents of a huge number of different disciplines at
point.
So these are actually instances where the fabric of science is being woven more closely together than rather than building all these silos, it seems to me.
That's right. That's right.
So the... in terms of your particular research program now, what specifically are you focusing on for the
In the future?
In the aging area,
Oh, in the aging area. In the aging area, we would like to study. We would like to understand broadly the when we talk about these chemical groups, we talk about one. We talk about one chemical group, an acetyl group. We would like to understand, so that's one acetyl group on one location in these packaging proteins for DNA. We would like to understand what are the changes that occur in many of these. We know there are a lot of different chemical groups that regulate the packaging. We would like to understand how do these chemical groups change through aging time and across the genome. We'd like to look at those two, across those data sets, looking.
Yeah, let's add one word in here, because mm-hmm. you've already said we already have the concept of the genome.
Mm-hmm.
We know about chromosomes.
Yes.
Which contain the genetic material.
Mm-hmm.
We know that the chromatin is the sort of packaging of the DNA within
right.
the chromosome.
That's right.
Another word that turns up a great deal is histone.
That's right, histone. Mm-hmm. So those are the proteins, the basic building blocks of this packaging material. There are four different histones that make up the nucleosome. Another new word. The nucleosome is composed of four of these different type of histones, each one two of each, and so it's called an octamer, for eight molecules. And the DNA, the double helix of DNA, is wrapped around this octamer two times, and that association of DNA plus histone protein is called the nucleosome. And so the nucleosome is sort of the basic packaging building block. And to get to the packaging in our cells, you need millions of nucleosomes and lots of higher order packaging to allow these long strands of DNA to be packaged into the nucleus. And so the histones are the substrate on which many of these chemical groups are placed. The histones are positively charged. DNA is negatively charged. That association is quite stable because of the electrostatic interaction between the histones and the DNA. And so these modification, these chemical groups that are put on, they can have two roles. One is to regulate the structure, literally change that electrostatic interaction between the histones and the DNA, opening it up, as I was telling you before, or closing it down.
Mm-hmm.
And a second role is to be a sort of landing platform for other proteins that are going to come in and, for example, turn genes on. And so it's going to form a nice little binding surface for the association of what we call effector proteins, the proteins that are going to carry out a process. Transcription, turning on and off genes is one. Replicating the DNA is the second one. And there are all sorts of other ones.
Mm-hmm.
All sorts of other processes that have to occur directly on the DNA that are regulated, that we know are regulated by changes in the chromatin structure. So, let's see, you asked me...
The trends of your future research
yes.
on aging.
So we would like to understand, in the aging area, So yeast is an absolutely fantastic model organism, and the reason is, it is the only organism where we can remove the genes in the cells, all the cells of the yeast that are making histone proteins, and put in new genes. That it's called ectopic expression. On top of we're putting in genes from the outside that we can put in any sort of changes in the histones that we want. So we can change particular locations in the proteins where we know these chemical groups are put on. So getting back to SIR2, we know the location. We know where the acetyl group is put on one of the histone proteins. We can alter that site, get rid of all the genes that the yeast makes, put in a new gene with a mutation in that site, we've altered that site, and ask what effect does that have. And the amazing thing is that we can alter the lifespan just with that single change. So we know that that acetyl group is critical.
By how much do you change the lifespan?
A lot. We can reduce lifespan by mimicking acetylation at that site. We can lower it by threefold. So that's quite a lot.
Okay, now explain why can't that be done in
other organisms?
Other organisms.
So in our cells, there are 30 copies of each one of those histone genes. Yeast have two copies. In addition, in yeast, it's very easy to do that ectopic expression. You know, we can manipulate, we have a lot of tools, molecular tools, to allow us to provide that ectopic copy with the changes that we want to examine and see what effect they have on aging.
But yeast was the only organism that you could do
yes,
this
to? Yes, yes.
What, not the worm or something like that as well?
No, worm is also, it's not possible to do this, at least with current technology.
Too complicated an organism?
Too many copies of the genes, of the histone genes, and it's too complex an organism to be able to, what we call, shuffle in the mutant copies to replace the wild type copies. So in yeast, we can do a systematic screen of literally every position in the histone protein, each of the four. We can do that for each of the four and ask which changes lead to extended lifespan and which lead to shortened lifespan. That's one of the things we want to do. Okay? So we can do this in yeast. We can find out new sites that we didn't know about that alter lifespan. And then we can take that information, figure out what the modification is, whether it's one we already knew about, what chemical change it is, whether it's one we already knew about or a new one. We can try, you know, it's discovery research as well. And then we can go into any organism we like, other models for aging, worm, mouse, human. And human cells, or even look in human. We saw a lot of this at the meeting. People are looking at aging humans and asking what kinds of changes, right, what kinds of these histone chemical changes are occurring as humans age. So we can do this discovery research in yeast where the tools are available, the approaches are available, and then we can move that research, what we find there, into more complex models and ultimately to humans.
And see if it does the same thing.
That's correct.
Which
see
it if, may or may not
well,
do. But it's
see
likely
if there's
to do.
Similar correlations with age. And then it's correlation. That's not causality versus correlation. In yeast, we can really get at the causes because we can make those mutations.
Right.
Can't do that in human cells. So we can look at the correlation in humans, and then we can, you know, there are things we can do in human cells, in human, you know, cell models, where we can, if we know what enzyme puts on, like SIR2 takes off that acetyl group, if we know what enzyme puts on an acetyl group or puts on a different sort of group, we can alter the level of that enzyme in human cells and ask, does that change the aging in human cells? So we can get there. It's just that yeast allows us to do the discovery research in an efficient, systematic,
right,
really, you know, rigorous, satisfying, on a very you know, pretty profound scientific level.
Right. Talking about discovery, mm-hmm. making these discoveries and so on, where did you begin the discovery trail? I mean, when did you know that you were going to become a scientist? And how, did you have a scientific parents as background?
No, or? My parents are, my father is a, was a design engineer at Ford Motor. I grew up outside of Detroit. My father was in the auto company. My mother was a bookkeeper. And they hadn't actually, they didn't go to college. So my generation in my family was the first generation to go to college. And
well, how did you know?
I was just fascinated as a child by the big questions, you know? What is that? You know, why do we die? I can remember thinking about that. You know, what is infinity? You know, what, those sorts of questions. How do things work? You know, how do biological systems work?
How old were you when you were thinking those questions?
The amazing diversity in animals, you know. Pardon me?
How old were you when you were thinking those questions?
Pretty young, I can remember thinking about it. And, you know, I remember thinking, gee, I really want to discover something. You know, when I was young, it was always just a very deep feeling that I want to do something, you know, to discover new things in the world.
Did you have
so
any?
I remember that from a young age. And then I'll just say that as an undergrad, studying animal behavior was a very triggering thing for me. I worked on a great moment for me. It's sort of ironic, was as I was finishing undergraduate work, I thought I would go into evolutionary behavior as a graduate student. And I went on a project for a summer studying ground squirrels and toads, studying their behavior with two scientists.
Where was this?
This was in Tioga Pass Meadow, which is just outside of Yosemite. I guess it's north of Yosemite.
Yeah.
And, you know, I spent the field season there thinking, this is the most fascinating stuff you could ever want to ask about. How do these behavioral systems evolve? And one of the scientists was studying two very closely related frog species. One had, and they had completely different mating systems, completely different ways of going about choosing their mate. So what could be more interesting than that, right? Closely related organisms, completely different behavior. How does that happen? But the questions were, for me, you know, so rudimentary. The tools were so primitive. But I did, you know, the guy I was working with who was studying ground squirrels did a fantastic experiment. He brought in two falconers. He wanted to know about the alarm calls of the squirrels. So he brought in two falconers that he had met at some Renaissance fair and had them in a controlled way fly the falcons over the meadow so that he could study the alarm calls of these squirrels. And that was the most graphic example of a controlled experiment I had seen to that day, and I still quote it. That was a very triggering moment for me. So at one and the same time, the idea that scientific inquiry and the scientific method was fantastic. I loved it because it's so rigorous, you know. But at the same time, I realized that wasn't for me. That line, I needed something faster moving because I like fast paced stuff, you know, fast paced research. At that time, 20 years ago, you'd go out to a field season with three questions you were going to ask over a whole field season. You may or may not get the answer, you know, and collect data to address that question. In the lab, you know, we are redesigning experiments on a daily basis. It's great fun. Yeah. It's just intellectually fascinating and fun. Yeah. So that was right for me, but here I am back at these questions. So it's really a very satisfying thing that now the tools, now we can formulate some questions. In these this question of epigenetics, basis of behavior, could that be, you know, an aging? could that be a centrally important mechanism underlying many of the disparate things? So could that be? You know, I hesitate to say I'm kind of a neophyte in the aging. Sounds like an oxymoron, but I hesitate to say, but it could be, could be that these epigenetic changes are central to all these different phenomena that we're seeing at the meeting. You know, all these different observations of oxidative damage, metabolic changes, pathways that are changing, could they all be impinging on the epigenome? And that's sort of the central mechanistic level where aging, where these things, changes that are occurring in the genome affecting all sorts of things, that's the theme, that's the central central thing.
It is sometimes presumed that somebody in childhood asking those big questions must be coming from a religious background.
Yeah. No, not at all. I mean, my family, I call them secular Jews, so, and I'm completely secular at this point.
So my point was, it is often presumed, is therefore not always correct. It's
yes.
often just a
Well, I don't know. I guess I think of it the opposite, that the religious, that very devout religious, individuals need, they're afraid to ask the questions. They want a simple, answer. They want to feel that there's a controlling entity or hand, and so unnecessary to understand how evolution occurred, how aging occurs. It's for me, religion is an anti inquiry.
Yeah.
So I think to the contrary, it stifles.
Inquiry. Well, it
don't
goes
quote
back
me on
to,
that.
It
but
goes
many
back
religious people, that are comfortable with inquiry and questions.
Well, you can't say don't quote me on that here. We don't take anything out.
That's the problem.
But that goes back to the point. I don't want to be too trite here, but that does go back to the point I made earlier about certitude and people being uncomfortable with the moving target and the change that is implicit, intrinsic, inimical, intrinsic to science. So,
you need a certain comfort level with
predictability,
doubt.
Pattern recognition, all those sorts of things.
Oh, you need to like it, lust for it, if you will, but have a comfort level with it. The dissonance, the cognitive dissonance that you got to always be questioning, waking up in the middle of the night, ooh, I don't understand that, or, you have a glimmer of an idea that comes to you. There is, a lot of inspiration, obviously, but you do have to have a comfort with
When you were talking about the alarm calls, I was thinking what actually flashed through my mind was Bob Chaney and Dorothy Seyfarth. And they're doing alarm calls with vervet monkeys.
Okay.
And the same. Who is the researcher you were talking about then? I was just curious.
That's a guy named Paul Sherman.
Oh,
he's at Cornell now.
I know.
So he was at Michigan. I went to University of Michigan as an undergrad. And he was working on the ground squirrels, and she became his wife, Cynthia Kagerice, was working on the toads. I worked with the two of them, and he's done fabulous stuff since then. You probably read about him. He's done stuff with spices and why humans use spices. He's done work on all sorts of really fascinating things. Milk? I saw something.
Naked mole rats, I believe, as
okay,
well.
Okay, so naked mole rats. Now, that, those are the mammalian equivalents of the ants social colonies. They, again, the females give up their reproduction and there's one queen female. So I've thought about, you know, giving Paul a call. Right. I haven't talked to him in years. Right. In fact, I have to tell you that when I told him I was leaving, I think I was writing to him for a recommendation or something, and I told him I was leaving, you know, evolutionary behavior and going into molecular biology, and he said, oh, you know, how can you stand that laboratory work, you know, the tick, tick, tick of the scintillation counter, how boring that is.
Yeah.
So, you know, was he right? No, in the sense that I have been working in molecular biology in the golden age of molecular biology, at the time where all of these tools are available and, you know, genetic research and systems biology have just blossomed and, you know, so much has been learned. And now we're at the point where we can sort of go back and perhaps address some of these absolutely big questions, you know, these gestalt questions of how does a behavior, how is behavior, you know, occur, how does aging occur, and you know, what are the molecular underpinnings of that?
It doesn't sound as though you sound as though you were sort of destined to be a scientist, but is there something else that you would have liked to have done if you hadn't been a scientist?
Actually, I really considered when I realized I wasn't going to, my destiny wasn't to become an evolutionary biologist, I thought about, I applied to a couple of programs in history and philosophy of science. I thought about, yeah, I was pretty serious about it. I started writing the essays, and I got a job as a technician in a molecular biology lab, and I just fell in love with it. It was satisfying to me on a pretty basic level, and I kept thinking, well, I can go back to writing, you know, later, and go back to philosophy, science if I choose later in my career, and it's kind of the way it's going. You know, in a way, these are more philosophical questions that I'm getting interested in, and I shouldn't overstate that I think that behavior is determined. You know, I mean, there's in human behavior, there's lots of plasticity, superimposed, but I do think there are, you know, there are some molecular underpinnings.
So you wouldn't be a genetic determinist, but. With your background, I mean, you must have read some Spinoza. You must, I mean, and
sure.
As a philosopher there who's talking about Deus sive natura, talking about the expression, the mm-hmm. connectivity, the interconnectedness of all things, and so mm-hmm. on and so forth. But he was also a determinist. So
no.
do you wrestle with those issues? Do you think about those questions? Whether we have any free will?
Oh, I absolutely believe in free will, and I'm really, you know, it does seem like a contradiction, but I think that humans are, you know, I believe in cultural evolution that's completely superimposed upon any of these biological and molecular questions. Yeah.
So we should have another conversation about this some other time, because the history of science, I think, mm-hmm. is an extraordinarily important element, mm-hmm. which, as you know, I'm greatly interested in as well.
Yes.
Science Network is interested in.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that, especially with the undergraduate audiences, it's one entree into a subject, that you
yes.
can bring alive some of the people who actually did some of the work
mm-hmm.
that
I agree
people
completely.
Are talking about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.